Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dry Dock episode 396. This week, the questions are taken from Guide 462 on the River or Thames class submarines, the Wednesday video on keeping the Royal Navy at sea and how that kickstarted the Industrial Revolution, and the Friday video on HMS Porcupine, which was blown in half and then went on to serve as two separate ships. So let's get on with the questions. Sir William Kidney asks, it seems like the River-Thames class finally fulfilled the long-sought requirements for a fleet submarine. Once it was commissioned, why did the Admiralty decide to focus on smaller subs now they finally had a class capable of keeping up with the fleet? Was it a change in doctrine? There were two elements as to why they didn't continue with this kind of submarine, both of which were shaped by the London Naval Treaty. The first was that the London Naval Treaty put a tonnage limit, this is the first London Naval Treaty, on the overall displacement of a submarine, namely 2,000 tons. Problem was that the River or Thames class displaced between 2,150 and 2,200 tons on the surface, which meant that while there was a clause that allowed you to essentially retain the big subs you'd already built, you couldn't build any more. So if they wanted to continue building something like the River class, let's call them the River class for the minute, then you would have to find some way of shaving about 200 tons off of the displacement of the sub. And if you did that, I mean, you could do that, but you would compromise a lot of the features that made it a viable fleet submarine. I mean, even if you took off that rather nice gun mounting and all the associated components, that's still not going to save you 200 tons. And therefore, it was not considered viable to continue. Now, of course, you could, in theory, have looked at an evolved design rather than just trimming a bit off of the existing class to try and get a viable fleet sub. And indeed, you know, about just under a decade later, the Gato class would prove you could come up with a viable fleet submarine at considerably less than 2,000 ton surface displacement. But the other big problem was that the London Naval Treaty included tonnage limits on the overall number of submarines as well. So it wasn't just each submarine can only weigh up to or displace up to so much. You also had now, like with capital ships, an overall headline figure and your combined submarine tonnage couldn't go above that. And even if they developed, let's say, a 1,999-ton fleet submarine, the Royal Navy had the same issue which they had with their cruisers, which was, well, global commitments. You need lots and lots of hulls to go everywhere, at which point they suddenly decided, okay, well, if we do have these limitations on overall tonnage, then it's better to look for smaller subs because, let's say, a 700-ish ton, 650, 700-ton sub, you can get three of those for the same displacement as a slightly reduced River class. And of course, that means you can have three separate subs in three separate places, which for the British Empire was quite an important consideration. Or you could have a couple of thousand ton displacement submarines, which at least let you be in two places at once. If the London Naval Treaty had, for example, had uncapped submarine tonnage, the way that the Second London Treaty uncapped the overall tonnage limits for an awful lot of different ship types, then I suspect you might have seen some kind of revised fleet submarine in the form of a revised River or Thames class come out next that just about skirted under those tonnage limits per sub. The man formerly known as Commenting Is What I Do asks, you've talked about the inefficiency of the Kriegsmarine's surface ships quite often, but when it came to submarines, was it a different story? How did the Allies compare to the Germans when it came to submarine design? Was it more of the same? Were they equal? Or was this one area that Germany was actually more efficient than the Allies? At the start of World War I, German submarine design efficiency wasn't as badly compromised as that of the German surface fleet, in part because, of course, the Germans had been covertly designing and building U-boats during the interwar period. Therefore, they had more experience going into, you know, when they started building them for their fleet. And also, submarines being relatively small have relatively speaking, much shorter design and build cycles than something like a battleship. And so you could iterate multiple times and you go, okay, well, that didn't quite work out. Try this. That didn't quite work out. Try this. And as you might guess from the fact that the Germans start off with the Type 2, the Type 7 and the Type 9, and they end up with the Type 21 and the Type 23, they also throw an awful lot of designs at the wall to see what may or may not actually work. And, well, most of them don't. But there are two important things to remember when you're trying to compare various submarine designs, and that is that different navies prioritize different things and are therefore willing to sacrifice different things. So comparing, say, a Gato class, which is designed primarily to keep up with the fleet over extremely long distances in the Pacific, with the German Type 7s or Type 9s, which are designed to operate independently of the fleet in much closer range waters, is not really a fair comparison. If the Germans try to build an extremely long distance submarine, like some of the later Type 9 variants and some of the ones they never quite put into production, that's a fairer comparison with a Gato. But, you know, a Type 7 and a Gato are two very, very different vessels. So when you have people capturing each other's submarines, for example, when the Germans capture a British S-class, they look at the S-class and they look at it in comparison to their own subs and they're not particularly impressed. Conversely, when the British capture some of the early German Type 7s in the early part of the war, they're not particularly impressed either. Both sides think that, you know, okay, there's a few things here that we could learn from, but by and large, our stuff is better. Now, of course, both of those points of view can't actually be true because, well, you can't have both sides better than each other. And this is, you know, where I'm coming from in terms of what you prioritize. If you prioritize certain things, then your opponent prioritizes different things, then obviously you're going to look at their sub and say, well, their sub isn't as good as ours in the things we prioritize, therefore they must be worse. That may not actually objectively be the case. So, for example, if we compare subs of approximately similar tonnage, and I'm going to use British subs because, well, you either have to use British or American subs, and Americans went really big for the fleet boats, which I said is not quite fair. So if you compare a Type 7 and an S-class, the Type 7 is a bit larger, displaces a little bit more, so it has a slight inherent advantage there, and obviously that will vary depending on exactly which variant of the Type 7 you're looking at. But broadly speaking, the British have a greater straight-up salvo. So the S-class has a 6-torpedo forward salvo, but no rear torpedo tube. The Type 7, generally speaking, only has a 4-torpedo forward salvo, but also has a rear torpedo tube. So if you're trying to spam a massive number of torpedoes at your opponent in one go, the British are doing it better than the Germans. But if you want to fire at somebody behind you, then you want the German sub. Also, generally speaking, again, somewhat a factor of their slightly greater size, the Germans are able to carry slightly more weaponry. They carry 14 torpedoes on Type 7C, for example, compared to 12 on an S-class. The German sub is considerably faster on the surface, but the British sub is significantly faster underwater. And it's actually very similar when you compare the T-class with the Type 9. And displacement there, again, depending on the Type 9 variant, is actually much closer. But again, the British sub has a far more powerful forward salvo than the Type 9, which is still, generally speaking, just using 4 tubes forward, and this time with 2 aft, whereas the British sub, well, the early versions, they start out with 10 forward and no aft, although various shenanigans occur that mean that exactly which way those torpedo tubes are pointing does change depending on the batch of the T-class, and of course some of those are external tubes, so that you only get the single salvo out of them, whereas obviously, with the Type 9, you can always reload. Although, even that said, if you just look at purely reloadable tubes, the Type 9 still only has 4 tubes forward compared to the 6 for the T-class. Again, the Type 9 carries slightly more torpedoes overall. And again, the Type 9 is faster on the surface, but slower underwater compared to a T-class. And you can go into range and all sorts of other characteristics, but essentially, what you can probably appreciate just from that brief overview is that the British subs were far more designed around getting close to somewhat faster targets, like, say, warships, and filling the water with massive numbers of torpedoes, and then getting away again as fast as possible, so operating against primarily warships in a more dangerous environment, whereas the German submarines had more torpedoes aboard and, generally speaking, were better suited for running at speed on the surface for longer distances and then stalking somewhat slower prey, like, say, merchant vessels, where your underwater speed mattered slightly less, but having lots and lots of torpedoes to just gradually pickle off one or two at a time at your various slow-moving targets was much more important. Now, that's with a kind of, you know, 39-40 view. As time goes on during World War II, that picture does change slightly. So while the Allies are looking to improve their submarines constantly, and they obviously do, the Germans are also looking to improve their submarines, but it is far more important and far more of a priority for the Germans because, of course, the U-boat is the only part of the Kriegsmarine that actually has a successful, or relatively speaking, successful continuous offensive purpose. The surface fleet really, you know, doesn't work in the end as an offensive arm. And so with the primary pressure on German naval design being build better U-boats and improve the ones we have already, German U-boats very quickly start to get longer range, deeper diving, more advanced torpedoes, and all this kind of stuff, and obviously culminating in things like the Type 21 and the Type 23, whereas for the Allies, there isn't that pressure. Japanese anti-submarine warfare sucks, although it's not completely non-viable, and the German surface fleet, both merchant and naval, is so tiny, and to a certain extent the Italians, but the Italians are slightly larger and slightly more competent than the Germans, but, you know, comparatively speaking, the Axis overall situation is that either there's plenty of targets but their anti-submarine warfare sucks, or their anti-submarine warfare is okay but the number of targets to go after is fairly small. But what we do need is we need more aircraft carriers, we need more escorts, we need a big surface fleet to launch offensive operations, and therefore Allied naval development is far more concentrated in surface warships and sub-hunting. And so you see, obviously, Allied advances in those areas going forward much in excess of Germany's, whereas Germany's advances through the war in submarine technology tend to outpace the Allies for the most part, which is why everyone's quite keen to get a look at things like the Type 21 after the war. Almirante Brown asks, did the Royal Navy consider building a class of large destroyers in the late 1920s or early 1930s as a response to Italy's Navigatori-class destroyers? And if so, what designs were considered, and which do you think would have been the best choice if the Royal Navy had decided to build those ships? To a certain degree, yes, but not immediately. So, of course, you had the Fubuki class coming out around about the same time in the late 20s, and while the Royal Navy did start building new destroyers in the late 20s, they were, of course, smaller 1,300 ton-ish fleet destroyers. And in much the same vein as the problem with the submarines and the problem with cruisers, the Royal Navy needed a lot of ships more than it needed a few big ones. And particularly in the late 1920s and early 1930s, you were looking at the Great Depression, much reduced funding, and at that point, if the Royal Navy wanted to have destroyers at all, then iterating on previous designs was cheaper, and keeping them small meant they could also get a decent number of them. Whereas if they said, hey, we want a design program for a brand new class of large destroyer, that's going to increase both the design costs and the individual build costs. They may get told to get stuffed regardless and not get anything, and even at their very best, they wouldn't get very many of them. However, the rise of larger and larger destroyers was seen as something of a problem, both in the fact that the London Treaty didn't cap destroyers at 1,300 or 1,400 tons, so their big ones were still around, and obviously some people decided, like the French and the Italians for that matter, that they weren't going to pay any attention to that clause anyway. And so in the early 1930s, there was a design that was drawn up, the famous Design V, or famous if you've listened to many, many of mine and Dr. Clark's videos. And, well, this is what Design V probably would have looked like. Many thanks to Zolli, who seems to have drawn almost anything that was on a paper sketch board between in the 20s and 30s. And if you're thinking, Drac, doesn't this look like a tribal class with an extra 4.7-inch gun turret stuck on it? Well, yes, it does. And there's a very good reason for that. And that's because this was an attempt to square the circle of, we don't have enough cruisers, we don't have enough destroyers, And even before they'd really fully engaged with the Arethusian Leander programs, they'd realized that while you might be able to squeeze an extra hull or two out of a fixed amount of displacement by building something like that instead of a 10,000 tonner, one, that didn't solve the problem of everyone else building a 10,000 tonner, and two, the slight increase in the number of hulls you got still wasn't enough. And so they decided to try and build a destroyer cruiser hybrid, which, depending on exact displacement and armament, because you could build variants thereof, could be put in either category, and you could therefore build a lot of them. And this is what they came up with. Then they decided this was a bad idea, and the tribal class is, broadly speaking, design V minus one of the forward turrets. And, well, if you recognize this particular gun layout, there's a good reason for that, because the other descendant of design V was the Dido class, like cruisers, which was essentially, well, what if we take this design, replace the twin 4.7s with twin 5.25s, and scale the whole thing up appropriately so that it can actually fit them? So this is it, the common ancestor, if you like. David Prophet asks, rumour has it that when the Japanese captured Singapore, they found reports of a British submarine or submarines patrolling very close inshore to Japan. Is that true, or did I imagine it? That is very true. And the submarine in particular that you're probably thinking of is this rather charming looking individual. This is HMS Regulus. And in the immediate run-up to the Second World War in the late 1930s, Regulus managed to penetrate well into the Inland Sea in Japan, that's off the Japanese coast. And the Japanese considered this basically a kind of exclusive area where they could do all sorts of fun naval exercises with nobody watching. And, of course, Regulus was watching and popped its periscope up and said, a Japanese carrier, I shall follow this. And as they were following it around, they went, another Japanese carrier. This one's not in our profile books. This one must be a new one. Most likely Soryu or Hiryu, given the time period, probably Hiryu. And they followed that around for a bit. And then they went, we're bored watching Japanese carriers now. Let's go and take some photographs of various Japanese port installations. And then, of course, I went back home. And home, at the time, was Singapore, because Singapore was the base for most British naval activity in the Far East at that point. And they lodged their reports and their photos and went off on their merry way. Ironically enough, by the time Singapore fell, Regulus had already been sunk. She'd been recalled back to the Mediterranean at the start of the Second World War and ended up lost to what was probably an Italian mine in 1940. However, by several accounts from both Allied intelligence and from Japanese accounts that survived the war, when the Japanese captured Singapore, one of the things they discovered was various submarine war patrol reports from the interwar period, and one of the particular reports they found was that of HMS Regulus with wonderful photos of Hiryu, and they kind of went, that was not something we were expecting the British to have been able to do. It's just as well all those submarines are somewhere else at the moment, which was probably true. Patalong asks, what, in your opinion, prevented clippers or earlier forms of clipper-like fast merchant ships from emerging earlier, like, say, the beginning of the 18th century? Was it just the technology, or was there not enough need for such ships' development at the time? Essentially need, I think, is the reason the clippers didn't emerge earlier. Because when you look at clipper ships, yes, they have speed. This is good. However, in order to have that speed, they sacrifice a significant amount of cargo carrying capacity for their overall dimensions, such as their length. So, you know, a more traditional merchant vessel of the same length will carry significantly more cargo. And also, they can carry virtually nothing in the way of armament, again, relative to their size, which in an era where you may have to fight off pirates is not a particularly good thing. And yes, of course, clippers are very fast ships, but that relies on the wind actually being there. If the wind isn't there, such as in coastal regions where you might need to go to pick up cargo, then other ships, such as perhaps ships with entirely fore to aft sail arrangements or ships with significant oars, will be able to catch you. And if you can't fight, then, well, you're a bit stuffed. And ultimately, you know, what cargoes needed to be moved particularly quickly? If you could move a small amount of something particularly fast, well, okay, you might get there first and you might command a small premium for your product. However, the other ship that maybe arrives a week or a month or so after you is carrying far, far more of that thing. And if there's no particular urgency to we need this and we need this yesterday, then you're just making less money on a ship that actually, because of the extremely fine engineering that goes into constructing it and the rather demanding nature of sailing one, actually requires more money to run. So it's just not worth it. Where clipper type ships start to evolve at the end of the 18th century is when suddenly there is a pressing need for speed beyond and exceeding the need for just reliable transportation of large cargoes cheaply. And that initially starts off with some coastal trade, because you start to see the rise of steamships, which obviously can maintain a steady speed to in the beginning of the 19th century. So your sailing ship needs to go faster than them, otherwise people will just go with a steam vessel. Also, the slave trade, as the Royal Navy starts to impose its restrictions on the slave trade, you need ships that can try and outrun the Royal Navy vessels. And somewhat prior to that, in various wars, blockade, as in consistent, constant blockade, was a fairly new thing. There had been temporary blockades of enemy ports in the 16th century, 17th century, early 18th century, but it was only in the mid 18th century with people like Admiral Hawke that the British started to pioneer a system of constant close blockade. So whereas before, merchant ships could just divert to other ports, or they could just hold off for a little bit and wait for the blockade to disperse and then they could head in. Now, if someone like the Royal Navy rocked up and said, hey, we're blockading this port, they could be there for years, at which point you needed something fast to run the blockade. Hence why some of the earliest blockade runners were also some of the earliest clippers, like the Baltimore clippers. And then, of course, as I said, you get things like slave trading vessels trying to outrun British and anti-slaving patrols. And then as you get into the middle of the 19th century, then you start to actually have relatively small, high-value cargoes for which speed of delivery is actually quite important, and the clippers grow into that niche. But prior to about 1780, there's just not necessarily, I would say, the need for one, but the compromises and expense of running one vastly outweigh the niche commercial benefits of running one in almost all cases. BK Zhang asks, is construction space or machinery the bigger bottleneck in ship construction? It depends quite a lot on time period and navy. So, for example, in the Age of Sail, in the 18th, 19th century and earlier, I would say at that point construction space is the bigger bottleneck, although for most nations at that point, the amount of space needed to construct a merchant or warship is relatively small, and coastlines being relatively undeveloped, you could find space. Now, finding the right kind of space in a port or a harbour could be a bit more constrained, but given that the machinery requirements are relatively limited, your space is going to be the bigger issue. Once you move on to the Age of Steam and Steel, however, it very, very much depends on who you are. If you are a relatively small country economically or navally, and you're trying to expand your navy, then very often machinery is going to be your bigger bottleneck. You may not have the tools to build the tools, or you might be able to import the tools, but you don't necessarily have the tools to maintain those tools. You might have plenty of space, but the kind of heavy lift cranes, like you can see in the background here, and so forth, that you may not have. And this is an issue in the various on and off South American naval arms races at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th centuries. It's just a very, very difficult proposition for them, because they do not have the industry to build new ships. They've got plenty of space. They can build as many harbours and docks as they like, but they can't build the ships. And even when they buy the ships, they don't necessarily have the infrastructure to support the ships. So, you know, they can do general maintenance, but if you want to do really big, heavy maintenance, like stuff with the machinery or the turrets, you have to send those back to the country they were built from. Conversely, if you're a very industrialized nation. Machinery might cost somewhat, but you should, in theory, have the industry to supply said machinery. And, you know, time may be an issue to manufacture it, but you can do it. But a lot of those more developed countries have far more space issues. Now, if you're the US, you're in luck because you have plenty of space and plenty of machinery. But for the older European powers, France particularly has problems with space because France has a very large coastline, but the vast majority of it is completely unsuitable for shipbuilding. So as an industrialized European power of the early 20th century, France can build the machinery, but a lot of the time they do not have the space to put in the larger dry docks and slipways and so forth that they want. And if they can find the space to do so, that usually means either having to go into somewhat unfavorable terrain, doing a lot of geoengineering, which makes things exponentially more expensive, or having to shove out pre-existing structures that are already there, which is also very expensive. Toxed asks, a question on coal. To transport it to the supply stations, did they use sail ships so that they didn't burn the fuel, or large steamships for volume? I would think they wouldn't want to burn 1 ton of coal just to get 2 tons to the destination. Coal is a classic example, at least for the majority of the time period the channel covers, of a cargo whose speed of arrival really doesn't matter all that much. As long as you've ordered it in reasonable time, so you're not going to run out if you're essentially just topping up existing stores, you don't really care if the coal you ordered arrives a month from now, 2 months from now, 3 months from now. You know, if you've got, say, 6 months of coal, and you think, okay, well, in 3 months, we're going to need to top that back up again to a 6 month margin. So you order your coal. If it arrives in, say, as we said, 3 months, no one particularly cares. If it arrives, you know, 2 months from now, you know, apart from anything, you might not have the space to store the coal, but it doesn't manifestly affect how you're going to be operating. And so colliers, for the very, very longest time, were essentially one step up from barges. A barge is not quite seaworthy enough, but of course coal is a very high volume, large bulk, high weight, or high mass cargo. And so you do need a ship that is somewhat stronger than the average merchant ship. So if you essentially imagine an enlarged barge with the barest modicum of an actual bow and some sails, that is essentially your sailing collier for a very, very long period of time. And of course, yes, if you sail, then you don't need to burn any of the coal. However, as demand for coal gets more and more, and as you say, we're talking about overseas supply bases, well, now distance is something of a problem, and your relatively slow colliers that could trundle up and down coastlines are less advisable for long-distance resupply of overseas naval bases because they may be slow enough that actually getting from point A to point B could start to take an unacceptably long time. And the crew, you know, are going to get very bored and going to have to carry absolutely massive amounts of food and water. Plus, the main reason you're putting coal in overseas bases is because of the arrival of steamships. Steamships are going to be eating up coal a lot quicker than just the kind of coal deliveries that you'd have for keeping places warm or even for running small industries like blacksmiths and so and forges. And so you need extremely large amounts of coal. And thus you would start to see colliers with iron hulls, because iron ships can be built bigger, therefore they can carry more coal, and the, you know, the square cube law works in your favor at that point. But as you now have these very large, very heavy vessels, sticking a bunch of sails on them, and they really, really do not want to move, plus they have an awful lot of inertia to them, so then you start to see the steam colliers coming in. And, you know, towards the latter third of the 19th century, you start to see more and more steam colliers. And then in the 20th century, as long as coal is the primary fuel of warships, the naval colliers are primarily steam vessels. However, the attractiveness of not having to burn coal to transport coal and other factors like general cost of running means that while steam colliers are very much common in the early 20th century, there's still actually quite a lot of sail colliers moving coal from big central depots along the coast to smaller ones and in more confined waters like the North Sea. Rashkavar asks, would bronze cannon not be considerably cheaper if not for all the decorative ornamentation on them? It seems consistent that bronze guns have considerable amounts of decoration that would add a fair bit of time and effort to the production. Or is that just something that they did back in the day to the ones that ended up being saved as museum or ceremonial pieces, and thus all the ones that are preserved happen to be decorated? Conversely, iron guns are often just kind of iron cylinders with a handful of features needed to make them a viable gun. There is a modicum of survivorship bias in that some of the earliest guns that are recovered, things like the guns from the Mary Rose or from Vasa, are from prestige ships and therefore would have prestige guns. And there's also the fact that bronze cannon overall, as in the big ones, tend to date from a period when the number of guns in a fleet was relatively small, or at least the number of large guns in a fleet was relatively small. And therefore, if you were going to commission a large bronze cannon to equip a ship, then, you know, the additional cost of the ornamentation is not really all that much, because guns are cast. So you cast the gun from a mold, which is made using obviously a master. So you only have to do all the fancy decoration once on the master, and you can create multiple molds from it. And bronze lends itself pretty well to pouring with lots of intricate details on it. As time goes on, bronze obviously gets displaced by iron guns because they're much, much cheaper to produce. Now, obviously, using the slightly additional material to cast the ornamentation does increase the value and therefore the cost of bronze guns somewhat, but it's relatively negligible compared to just the overall quantity of material used, and therefore it's far more the actual cost of bronze period that starts to rule bronze out of being used as the primary component or primary material for naval guns. But as I said, you know, once you've produced the master from which you're creating the molds, it's not actually a huge amount more effort to cast a really decorative bronze gun as compared to an iron gun. Now, for various reasons, including things like the temperature of the material you're pouring and of the material itself, while you can cast decorative iron cannons, it is a little bit more difficult and the results are a little bit, not cruder, but they're a lot harder to finish to a high detail. And also, iron guns are just produced en masse. So if you're making, let's say, a dozen big bronze guns for two prestige ships that you're building, and you're going to put six on one and six on the other, the relatively small amount of additional material that you're using and the slightly increased cost of paying someone to produce the master for the molds, you know, it might increase the overall bill by the cost of a quarter or half of an additional bronze gun, but for a prestige ship, you're not really going to care. Conversely, if you're ordering 900 24-pounder iron guns, not only is decorating them less important, but at that scale, then the amount of money that you're paying for the additional decoration, which, as we said, won't look as good anyway, the amount of extra material, etc., that actually starts to add up to, oh, we could have had half a dozen extra guns for that. And suddenly, because the numbers of guns are more important, then you start to see decoration on guns start to diminish. It doesn't go away completely. There are a number of iron cannon out there that do have varying levels of decoration on them. But the iron ship's gun as a whole is more often just a mass-produced weapon, not a prestige item. And also, as iron guns become more and more prevalent, and guns themselves, as I said, kind of just become a mass production item, there are bronze guns produced that are very plain. Bronze is still used, for example, in the 18th and 19th century for signal guns. And if you've ever seen a 18th or 19th century bronze signal gun up for sale, if you're lucky, it might have a little, you know, embossed thing that says which ship it came from, but that's really about it. They look just like shiny versions of the iron guns. Unusually being single and somewhat smaller. They don't have all the fancy decoration that you'll see on something fished up from Mary Rose or Vasa, for instance. Barry Elverson asks, you said the Industrial Revolution meant that ships could and would become standardized. So I'm wondering, which were the first of the class ships and what were some of the last one-offs? What type of ship were the first to become class ships, and were they smaller ships or bigger ones? And was there any correlation to types of ships coming about because of standardisation, thus creating certain classes of vessel? Well, it's difficult to point to exactly what the first class ship would be, because, as with so many things, quite often terms get retroactively applied. But if you want to look at the sort of the first large-scale systematic attempt to say this is, you know, a type of ship and we are going to build it to this specification and there are going to be lots of ships to this specification, as opposed to perhaps one-offs where someone just went, hey, we built this really cool ship, how about we build a bunch of copies of it because that one worked out really well, which was kind of the general approach in the earlier part of the Age of Sail, then you'd probably be looking at the Royal Navy's establishments. So starting around the 1700, around the beginning, very, very beginning of the 18th century, although the move towards it is happening in the late 1600s as well. So establishment ships are so-called because they're based on the establishment that was made for the Navy, and those are literally design specs that we would recognize as a class. So they say, okay, if you want a 60-gun ship, it's going to be this long, it's going to be this wide, it's going to carry this many guns of this type, etc., etc. And so it provides you a template, and in theory, all ships of that size and that gun burden should be the same. Of course, in the Age of Sail, that generally doesn't quite work out that way, because individual shipbuilders will have their own slightly unique ways of doing things, but at least they're broadly similar, and classes move on from there. Now, during that period, so the 1700 period through to 1750, while there is an increase in classes, or the establishments get changed, so the specifications get changed, but other people catch on and start building batches as well, there are still ships that are one-offs. So, for example, ships of the line, you've got what would later become the first rate, second rate, third rate, fourth rate. But the fourth rates and the third rates, so the two-deckers essentially, those are built in reasonable numbers. But the three-deckers, what used to be called the great ships, the 100-gunners, etc., these are still built very, very rarely, you know, maybe one a decade, sometimes less. And therefore, those are still very much one-offs, because they design a ship, they build the ship, and then 10, 15 years later, when they want to build another ship, there'd have been enough changes in how people thought ships could be built that a new one would be designed. Or even if they were taking a design from a previous one, there would be a significant number of modifications. And because the establishments cover everything from two-decker ships of the line all the way down to tiny frigates, there's no particular, oh, well, this particular size of ship leads to classes. It's just kind of a block-built thing. Now, with that said, one-offs never really quite go away in the time period the Channel covers, but they do get rarer because, of course, there's a certain amount of cost that goes into designing a ship, and as ships get more complex, the design work also gets more complex, which therefore means the design work gets longer and more expensive. So if you are planning to put all that money and effort into designing something, you may as well build a lot of that thing, because that splits the development costs across multiple ships. So using World War II costs, for example, if it's going to cost you, let's say, £20 million to build a really big fancy cruiser, and it's going to cost you another £10 million to design that cruiser. So if you build one of them, it's cost you £30 million to build that one cruiser. However, if you decide to build 10 of those vessels, well, you might be thinking, okay, well, then it's going to cost you £21 million per ship, because you're spending £20 million on the ship and you're splitting the £10 million you spent designing it, £1 million on each vessel. However, of course, you also have economies of scale, which means the actual cost of building each ship might go down. So let's say you save 5%. By building at scale. So you build 10 ships, you save 5% on your £20 million cost, so it's only costing you £19 million per ship, and then suddenly you split your £10 million design cost across the whole lot. Okay, that pushes the cost back up to £20 million, but now you're getting 10 hulls at £20 million per hull, and your design costs have essentially disappeared in terms of your overall budget. So at that point, you can then go to Parliament or the Treasury or whoever and go, okay, well, we want to design and build a new class of heavy cruiser. We want to build 10 ships and it's going to cost us 20 million per ship. That's it. You don't have to explain all the complexities of added design costs and so forth, assuming everything goes correctly or naturally. But it doesn't mean that one-offs disappear because, well, sometimes a country just can't afford more than one of a thing, or it's a planned class that gets a curtailment of a run for whatever reason, or it's just big enough and mean enough they don't think they need more than one. So Dreadnought, of course, is a one-off. The Bellerophons and St. Vincents are similar, but they are recognised as separate designs. And, of course, the very last battleship ever actually built, HMS Vanguard, hence the picture here, is a one-off. In her particular case, there were ideas to build multiple Vanguard types, but as it happened, they only end up building the one, and so she's a singular vessel, and therefore her overall cost includes the total design costs for her. Camrim asks, are you selling signed copies of your book to the US? And the answer to that is yes, in theory. So keep an eye on my website's store, the Victualler's Yard, on drakenneveld.co.uk, because yes, in principle, I have no problem with selling you a signed copy of my HMS Belfast book wherever you are in the world. However, I've run out of copies, and I did put in an order to restock my copies November last year, and the people who were supposed to be shipping it to me still haven't shipped it. So I've cancelled that order and put in a new order. And, well, when they arrive, then I will sign them and send them off. And, well, when they arrive, they'll be available for people to purchase. And, you know, I owe a couple of people a couple of books, but I don't have any at the moment, so I need to get some more in. But, yeah, when they are available, then I will do so. And perhaps the next time I'm in the States for any particular length of time, I might just order a bunch straight from USNI and have them sent to wherever it is I'm staying, and then I can dispatch from there. But unfortunately, I didn't think to do that when I was in San Francisco this time around, so oh well. Vokia asks, were Lemnos and Kilkis suitable candidates for any substantial overhaul in the 1930s? And how might they compare to the German pre-dreadnoughts? Would there have been useful units come World War II? It's actually very interesting to compare the Schlesien and Schleswig-Holstein to Lemnos and Kilkis. They actually start out displacing about the same. The German ship, however, has obviously four 11-inch guns and a whole bunch of 6.7-inch, I think, in their secondary battery. The American and later Greek ships are slightly more heavily armed in the secondary department. They actually have 16 secondary guns and split 50-50 between 8-inch guns and 7-inch guns. So the overall weight of guns and number of guns is larger. And of course, the 8-inch come in turrets, which amplifies the weight still more. But the Greek ships are shorter and wider, the German ships therefore being longer and slimmer, which means that the German ships actually can go a little bit quicker, and even the armour is broadly similar. So that suggests that as long as you're prepared to accept they might be a bit slower than the German ones, the Greek ships theoretically could have been candidates for overhauls in the mid-1930s if the Greeks could actually afford to do so, which obviously historically they didn't. But if they had done so, what would they have been useful for? Well, with 9-inch maximum armour and being pre-dreadnoughts, and even with brand new machinery, probably still sub-20-knot vessels, they're not going to be a particularly effective deterrent against most things. But if they'd had, say, completely modernised fire control systems, worked together, perhaps had a lot of the secondary distributed armour deleted and just retained primary belt armor, maybe even with some of that weight saved, increase the belt armor slightly. As a team, they potentially could have been a deterrent to a single Italian refitted ship, like a Cavour or something like that. Obviously, you'd need to modify the turrets for longer range fire and so forth. Individually, of course, a Cavour would still overwhelm them, but combined, although still outgunned, I certainly would perhaps think twice about engaging them. But again, acting as a combination unit, they would actually be a very effective deterrent against Italian heavy cruisers, perhaps even on their own, because, of course, the 12-inch guns, with modern fire control and better elevation, could reach out and really hurt even a Zara class. And even if they just kept their existing armor layout, perhaps trimming some of the more thin plates at the extremities, their armor's still good enough to withstand 8-inch shellfire at decent ranges. So where they might have been slightly worse off compared to the German ships, as I said, with a shorter and beamier hull, you're just not going to make them very quick. So very much coastal defense ships, not really suited for any kind of offense. Of course, historically, they just get bombed in port by the Luftwaffe. But if you were going to do a full refit, I would suggest that actually with that somewhat extra beam, if you did do a full modernization, if you stripped off all of the 7-inch and 8-inch guns, including the turrets and so forth, you'd actually have quite a lot of deck space that you could then refit with some kind of dual purpose for 4.5, 4.75-inch armament. And that could actually make them very effective convoy escort vessels, because you'd have a massive amount of anti-aircraft firepower. Obviously, you wouldn't just put heavy AA guns on, you could put light and medium AA guns on as well. And in that guise, they might have actually made very good convoy escorts. Now, they're not going to obviously deter something like a Scharnhorst that shows up, but much as they would be a good deterrent against Italian heavy cruisers, they would be a very good deterrent against Hipper-class cruisers coming on commerce raiding, Hilfskreuser, etc., with a good secondary and anti-aircraft battery. They'd also do pretty well at seeing off Condors and so forth. The only slightly marginal thing would be if they came across a German Deutschland-class Panzerschiff, because the Panzerschiff would have two extra guns. But especially if they upgraded the armor by making it a more all-or-nothing rather than distributed system, but even with its existing armor system, a Kilkis or Lemnos would actually stand up to incoming fire better than the Deutschland would take the 12-inch fire in return. So essentially, as long as you weren't running into a Scharnhorst or a Bismarck, these things would make really, really good convoy escorts. Or potentially shore bombardment ships for amphibious support, because if you're going in with an amphibious assault fleet, your speed isn't really too much of a problem, and then you've got your big heavy guns to shoot things on land and your big secondary and anti-aircraft batteries to defend yourself from the inevitable counterstrikes. Vinve asks, during the South American dreadnought race, was there a difference in the quality and training of ships' crews? And what about their doctrine? Did all three navies expect to use their ships in the same way? There was quite a difference in quality of training and crew. Although, obviously, you have the period during the dreadnought race immediately afterwards and so forth, and things do vary because all three navies go through some quite significant developments during the early 20th century. But let's say for the mid-1900s and early 1910s, the period when the race is actually really truly going on, the Chileans, having fairly good relations with the British, model their navy quite significantly on the Royal Navy. Conversely, the Brazilians, although obviously they're buying the Minas Gerais class from Britain, let's just say the officer crew divide is quite extreme, because you do actually get relatively soon after the ship's enter service, what's called the Revolt of the Lash in Brazil, where the crews just go, you know what, you're treating us literally like slaves, we're not going to take this anymore. That kind of gives you an idea of, some of the issues present in the Brazilian Navy at the time. Of course, some of your biggest capital ships deciding they were going to start lobbing shells at your government buildings does drive something of an institutional change. So by the 1930s, let's say, it's a rather different story. And doctrinally, yes, each navy was thinking very, very differently. So, of course, everyone was thinking about potentially having to fight everyone else. But one of the larger doctrinal differences you might see is if you look at, say, the Chileans. And one of the things that the Chileans have going for them is with the Almirante Latorres, they specifically have additional boilers beyond that which is necessary to get them to their target speeds built in, so that they can shut down boilers and do maintenance while the ships are at sea. And so they can cycle through boilers during long deployments, because the Chileans, particularly, Obviously, they are on the western side of South America. They're expecting, if they end up fighting either the Argentinians or the Brazilians, that their ships will have to go around the, well, the southern tip of South America, the really stormy bit, and they are planning to then fight either the Argentinians or the Brazilians in the Atlantic on the eastern side of South America. And they're not expecting them to necessarily come back around for a full refit for quite a while. Hence, they need considerable, if you like, overseas expeditionary capability. Whereas the Brazilians, while fighting Chile is potentially on the cards, they're far more worried about the Argentinians, so they're focused on a much closer range scenario and also a degree of harbour defence. And the Argentinians are kind of stuck a little bit in the middle. They might have to fight in the Pacific, they might have to fight in the Atlantic, they might have to fight at distance, they might have to fight in close, because they have ongoing disputes with both Chile and Brazil. Chris Knight asks, most are familiar with the battle turn starboard of the High Seas Fleet, which executed at Jutland. Was there also a battle turn to port? And if not, why did they pick starboard and not port? There was indeed a battle turn to port, because the battle turn tactic was, of course, everybody turning simultaneously as opposed to in succession, and that is agnostic of whether you're turning to port or starboard. However, the reason why they chose starboard and not port at the Battle of Jutland in particular was to do with where they were facing the British. So Jellicoe had managed to, roughly speaking, cross the T of the German fleet. However, it wasn't a perfect capital T crossing. If you look at maps of the time of the battle, the Germans were heading, roughly speaking, northeast-ish, and the British battle line was in kind of a chevron-style formation. So it wasn't a line, but the rear part of the line was going, roughly speaking, east-northeast, and then at a certain point it turned and it was going kind of east-southeast to essentially cap off the Germans. And that meant that from Scheer's perspective, if he did a battle turn to port, he would be turning towards the enemy. And since the whole point of the battle turn was to try and disengage from the enemy, turning towards them, getting closer and therefore more visible, wasn't really a particularly brilliant thing, because all that would do is give the British more time and more clarity to shoot at them. And of course, the Germans would have to flip their turrets all the way around if they wanted to continue engaging. As you can see here in this depiction, the Germans are engaging to port. If they do a 180 to port, then they've got to turn all their turrets around to starboard. And that obviously takes time, but also it means they're going to have to reset all their fire control solutions. Whereas if they do a battle turn to starboard, theoretically, yeah, the same issue would apply. You'd have to flip your guns all the way around to re-engage. However, by doing a battle turn to starboard, you're also going away from your opponent and thus fading away into the mists, and thus you don't actually have to continue firing because you've disappeared, which, as I say, was the main point of the battle turn away, was to break contact. Sir Lawrence Hood asks, what did the Japanese know about the Iowa class? I could imagine they had bigger problems to deal with at the time, but did they ever think about a way to counter them? The Japanese didn't know a huge amount about the Iowa class beyond, well, what the US was happy to let the general public know, because by the time the Iowa class were well underway, well, World War II was well underway, and more specifically, the hostilities between Japan and the US were very much well underway for the vast majority of the Iowa class's build period. And even if the Japanese had access to all the specs, about the only thing that they would have been worried about was perhaps a little bit of the speed. But if they'd looked at the rest of the specs in terms of firepower and armor, obviously not knowing exactly how capable the 16-inch 50 gun was, they would have just looked at the Yamatos and gone, bigger. Yamato has same amount of guns, but bigger guns. It has considerably thicker armor. Okay, it's a little bit slower, but, you know, whatever. And the natural counter would just be to continue building Yamatos. But of course, you know, even though the Japanese had plans for the A-150s and they had additional Yamato class on the stocks, they didn't go through with continuing construction on them. And of course, Shinano got turned into a carrier because ultimately they, as you said, they had other things to deal with. If they'd really, really been worried about the Iowas, which I don't think they particularly were in and of themselves, then they would have just kept building Shinano and her sister ship and the other sister ships planned for the Yamatos. Brian Smith asks, I know that this question comes perhaps from near the end of what the channel covers, but when and why did submarines move to one central propeller at the end of the pressure hull, and who was the first to do that? Well, there were submarines with one central propeller from relatively early in the submarine story. A lot of it just depended on size and how much importance you placed on underwater speed, because a single propeller is better for the stern shape of a submarine that wants to go fast underwater. So, for example, as you can see here in this plan of the World War One R-class submarines for the Royal Navy, you'll note a single propeller shaft aft. Also helps that this is a fairly small submarine. Most diesel-electric submarines, though, would have two or more propeller shafts, but this was for a number of reasons beyond just speed. It was also to do with charging and reliability. So those two things are slightly separate. So with the reliability aspect, of course, we are still talking early 20th century diesels. There is a chance something could just stop working and need maintenance. And in that event, if you just have one set of diesels driving one shaft and they stop, well, then you're in trouble, because, well, you end up like the US R-class, the R-14, when... In that case, it has two sets of engines, but when they stop, you're left with a minimal amount of battery power, whatever you happen to have in the tank at the time, and potentially sails, and that's really about it. So it was generally held, well, if you have two or more propeller shafts and two or more sets of diesels, then something goes wrong with one, you can at least limp along on the other. There were also issues about the power output on any substantial size. I mean, as I say, the British R-class, as seen here, pretty small, but on very large submarines, getting a decent power output out of diesel engines was an ongoing problem, just in general. And so trying to put essentially double the amount of power through one diesel into a single propeller shaft on a 1,500, 2,000, 2,500 ton sub is just not going to happen at that point in time. So, hence the need for multiple shafts. The other issue, as I said, is charging. Now, this is not necessarily applicable to all diesel-electric submarines. It very much does depend on how they are configured. But in a lot of submarines at the time, if you had the engine running, then you could charge the batteries, or you could drive the propeller shaft, but not both, or you could charge the batteries and maybe drive the propeller shaft, but whatever energy was left over to drive the propeller shaft would be what was left after a bunch of energy gone into charging the batteries. So if you only have one propeller shaft, then when you surface, you can charge your batteries or you can maneuver, but not both, which is obviously a big disadvantage in time of war. And even in situations where you have separate diesels to charge the motors and separate diesels to move the sub around, on a lot of those types of diesel electric subs, you could potentially link one or the other of your main drives to help charge the battery. Or if you wanted to do economical cruising, then you could perhaps run off of one propeller and thus only run on half your diesels. Whereas obviously if you only have one propeller, you're just running on those engines regardless of what happens. So as a matter of redundancy, a matter of fuel efficiency, and in some cases a matter of being able to maneuver on the surface if you also wanted to charge a battery, although that bit isn't necessarily a universal thing, is essentially why almost all diesel electric subs end up with two or more propeller shafts. And indeed, that actually continues in a lot of early nuclear subs. If you, and even Cold War diesel electric subs, as far as I'm aware, still until very recently comparatively have had twin shafts. And it's only in, I believe, and again, post 1950s, so take this with a pinch of salt, but I believe it's the second or third generation US nuclear attack subs that are the first to go in properly with single shaft propulsion. I know HMS Dreadnought, the first British nuclear sub, has single shaft propulsion, but that post dates, I believe it's the Skipjacks, I think are the first US subs that go in with single shaft nuclear propulsion, but the ones that precede them, including things like the Nautilus, a twin shaft. And then, of course, because you have nuclear reactors, so suddenly power output is not so much of a problem, then obviously you can optimize for speed and go with single shaft propulsion from then on. And finally for this week, Jeffrey Connolly asks, "Hello, Drac. You are sent back in time to around about the time of the launch of the Invincible class and are put in charge of designing and building a battlecruiser for the United States. Your only limitations are that their design needs to be based off the Tennessee-class armoured cruiser, have a main belt capable of protecting against most last-generation armoured cruisers, and have a main battery of 12-inch guns. Top speed, 25 knots. If budget is not an issue, what would such a ship look like, and what would you name her?" So here's an option. This ship is capable of 25 knots. It uses coal with oil firing sprayed onto the coal. As you can see, it's using vertical triple expansion engines, hence lots and lots of funnels. It's got the rather ridiculous cage masts that the US Navy was really into in the mid-1900s. It can go 25 knots. It's got 8 inches of armor everywhere except the turrets, which are somewhat better protected. And that is designed to give you protection, as you mentioned, against pretty much any last-gen armored cruiser, because the Invincibles with their 6-inch plate were designed to stand off against, roughly speaking, 8-inch gunfire, 8.3-inch, whatever, at longer ranges. With this, I'm looking at, well, my last armored cruisers is in the Tennessee's a 10-inch arm, so maybe they can punch a little bit harder, and I might want to get a little bit closer as well. So that's going to be why I've gone for 8-inch armor instead. And as you can see, I have 6 12-inch guns. Because again, if I'm the US, I'm going to go, I want all my guns on the center line. And while having 8 guns would be nice, I can't quite fit it in this. Potentially, if the engines are a little bit more efficient, or if I go over to turbines, then I might be able to drop a funnel, move the aft cage mast forward, and then fit a fourth twin 12-inch there, super firing. But compared to the Invincibles, yes, the Invincibles do have 8 guns, but as we know with cross-deck firing, it's only at a very, very limited set of angles. With this design, I've got more protection, almost the same speed, and I've actually got the same broadside over most arcs. And as I said, with a few minor changes, you could get it up to a true 8-gun broadside, but at that point, I've just essentially invented a faster version of the South Carolina class. So I thought this would be a little bit more of an interesting one. And that's it for this video. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening, if indeed you still are, and I hope to see you again in another video soon. But bye for now.